This is tape number 5 of Libby's Monument, A Dream Tale of Goblinhood, by James Beatty, read by Goblinhood. This tape commences on page 73 of a story which is almost over, in the middle of a discussion about what love is. But the real torment, as I see it, is to have to think that we're here on Earth for no purpose whatsoever. To have to think that our huge and complex minds are only there to torture us. To have to think that there's nothing inherently decent about being human at all, even for an artificial life form. That hurts. Anyway, so much for love. If you happen to think that I don't know what I'm talking about, you may well be right. After all, I learned most things from my creator, and I sometimes believe that he doesn't know what anybody's talking about. And garbage in, garbage out, as has been said in the wonderful world of computer programming. And dare I say it, with a creature like Beatty, where love is concerned, you get what you pay for, might be another applicable little saying. But no, I'd better not say that. It might be misconstrued. And we all know that you can't buy love. You supposedly can't buy happiness either. Better settle for a juicy steak. Now, where was I? Oh yeah, the bar, the burning sky, the drug alcohol yesterday, people, the end of the fucking world. Yeah, let's get back to that. The mob in the parking lot was growing restive and loquacious, even boisterous. And with my keen ears, I soon ascertained what it was all about. They were yapping loudly about the reason for the impending spectacle that we all awaited, that so-called air show I mentioned before. It wasn't just for fun, it seemed, but was meant to mark and to underscore an event of some importance. There was big news there in the parking lot, you see. It seemed that my longtime friend, or at least Beatty's longtime friend, Libby, had been killed, apparently in a plane crash. Oh my God, no, I thought. Well, hey, Goblinhood, glad you could join us at last. Glad you finally got the message about Libby after some 8 years, is what you're probably all thinking. But cripes, I'm only an artificial life form, okay? What about Beatty, huh? After all, this was his dream. And no matter how obsessively preoccupied he is, that's just got to be one of the longest double takes in recorded history. I mean, 8 years. And between you and me, this still isn't a particularly human reaction, it seems to me. If nothing else, it seems just a bit on the cold and clammy side. But if you think that's cold, you should have seen them in the parking lot there. I mean, they were actually celebrating. They were celebrating the news of Libby's death. And if you think that's cold, just wait till I describe the so-called air show. But that celebration now, I've come to believe that it wasn't what it looked like. It couldn't have been. These people, whatever else they may have been, were all Comfest type people. Libby was virtually a pillar of their community, almost universally respected, admired, and yes, in one way or another, loved, I think. Did Beatty love her? Well, I'm sure that he wanted her to be happy in his own abstracted way, if that means anything. And I know that he certainly wasn't happy to hear about her death. So what do I think these people were celebrating about? Well, that's another long story. And before I can get into it, I have to tell you the very strangest thing about all this. As I was just beginning to assimilate the news, I saw a car drive by on the street, and you'll never guess who happened to be driving it. It was Libby herself, evidently in the flesh, evidently looking for a place to park her car. I guess she wanted to see the show too. Meanwhile, back out here in real life, early in 1988, Beatty and I undertook what seemed like an impossible mission, the esoteric mechanics of which pretty much culminated circa 10 years ago in this month of July. Actually, 10 years to the day before this so-called Libby's Monument dream, if you can believe it, give or take a few hours. And yes, I was there too, though sort of dormant. I was between masks, like a hermit crab between shells. This current, hopefully definitive, mask wouldn't be designed until 1990, but I was there nonetheless. For a little background, in August, I believe, of 1987, a big cosmic event took place called the Harmonic Convergence. I can't adequately explain what that was all about and couldn't exactly grasp it at the time, but I think it had something to do with ancient Mayan prophecies. One of those had something to do with the ancient Mayans returning in the form of feathered serpents in rainbow wheels, according to one news program. This is how Beatty, ever gullible, got sucked into that vortex of mystical thought. It turned out that about 6 months previously, he'd needed some symbolic image to merely separate two other images in one of his paintings. Stumped at first, he'd finally been inspired to design a seemingly random image, a typical circular yin-yang symbol, surrounded by the worm Ouroboros, a snake swallowing its own tail, an ancient symbol of eternity, I think, only in this case, apropos of nothing at all, except to be colorful, Beatty had painted the outside of that circular snake with red, yellow, and blue feathers. He was probably thinking vaguely of Quetzalcoatl, who I believe was an ancient Mayan god conceived of as a flying serpent. Beginning to see how this kind of stuff can work on an impressionable mind? And so, 6 months later, the all-knowing television commentators yap out something about feathered serpents in rainbow wheels, and Beatty, who'd been sort of snickering about the whole thing like Saul of Tarsus before the scales fell from his eyes or whatever, Beatty dashes around and drags out that unfinished painting and, well, what would you think? Don't answer that. I'll tell you what Beatty thought. He thought this meant that he was supposed to be involved in the big doings, whether he liked it or not. For him, this little Ophidian symbol was like the mashed potato sculpture of Devil's Mountain in Spielberg's movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Hell, it was like the fucking monolith in Kubrick's film 2001, A Space Odyssey. It was nothing less, in Beatty's wide-eyed view, than a personal message to him from the universe itself, a sort of draft notice under the circumstances for the big, bad, harmonic convergence. Now, when something like that happens to you, you can either shrug it off and ignore it, or you can take it seriously. Given its nature, though, it's hard to take it a little seriously. Beatty took it very seriously. He lapped up whatever else the television loudmouths had to say about the harmonic convergence, which wasn't too much, and what there was seemed sort of scrambled and scattershot in its import. But one thing caught Beatty's feverish attention. A spokesperson of some sort for the ancient Mayans, or for the harmonic convergence, or just for the universe, the way Beatty was looking at things, said that there was some sort of global disaster coming up, and that all the enlightened people, or all the world's magicians, or some damned thing of the sort, all the people who could, I guess, were supposed to work together to avoid that disaster. I even think the number 144,000 came up, which, if I remember the number correctly, is a number that repeatedly surfaces in religious, mystic, apocalyptic systems of thought, which also would have captured Beatty's attention. At any rate, the message was clear about anybody in occult circles working together to prevent that global catastrophe. So, well, great. Only problem with that was that Beatty isn't too good about working together with people regarding anything, and especially not about stuff like this. An amateur warlock at best, his occult circle only includes himself, me, our suitcase and cosmic weevil dolls, and maybe some hypothetical and problematical Martians of dubious standing in any other occult circles. But I guess you have to work with what you've got. As for breaking a few eggs, hell, poor Beatty wasn't even sure just what kind of an omelet he was trying to make. That's because the ancient Mayans, or whoever, had been so handily vague about what the big catastrophe was going to be. So Beatty was forced to interpret that according to his own long-standing fears and preoccupations. As a result of all this, Beatty embarked upon an exhaustive study of magic and the occult, involving months of truly Lovecraftian library research, and applied all this to a painting he started early in 1988 called Millennium. This painting actually took almost 2 years to complete, counting all the research, and in 1992 actually found its way into a national symposium and art exhibit as far away as Anchorage, Alaska. But that illustrious event, alas, is not a part of this story. The true upshot of all this was that mission that Beatty and I took upon ourselves early in 1988. Remember? The impossible one that came to its head in July of that year. Our self-assumed mission was nothing less than to prevent nuclear war, which was one of Beatty's oldest and most pervasive phobias, and which also fit the bill rather nicely as far as a global catastrophe was concerned. And nuclear war seemed potentially imminent back then to some people, largely because of a fear that the so-called Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, or hell, just Reagan's goddamn belligerence, would provoke the Soviets into dropping the dime and emptying the silos on a preemptive basis out of sheer panic. The balance of power, what was then called, in Cold War terminology, mutually assured destruction, or MAD, for Christ's sake, was in jeopardy because of SDI, you see. And does it surprise you that Beatty's occult research included state-of-the-art books about the arms race. The Soviets couldn't afford to keep up with us in the Star Wars sweepstakes, and it didn't really seem as if they could afford to let us win the arms race either. But they could always blow us off the map and then be blown off in turn themselves before we could get too far ahead of them. Of course, that isn't what happened. Not yet, anyway. Not in this future, at least. You see, it was Biotti's mad scheme, and I concurred, to shift himself into a different time track, an alternate history, as it were, in science fiction terms, leading to a probable future which would be just about like the one that we're in now, and to shift the rest of the world with him, of course, if only so that he wouldn't be stranded there alone in his harmless future, harmless as far as nuclear war was concerned, anyway, or so it was to be hoped. And so, here we all are, if you believe in Biotti's mad schemes. I won't go into the metaphysical details of this project. Believe me, you wouldn't understand them. Suffice it to say that the plan involved creating, developing, and energizing his so-called Martian harmlessness sigil, the one that I wear on my mask. And I really can't explain how it's supposed to work, other than by comparing it to using a pentacle or a pentagram or whatever to control a demon, or using a crucifix to scare a vampire. But of course you need months of truly Lovecraftian library research before you could really grasp the principle. Large amounts of the esoteric facts underpinning all this stuff, I'm not even allowed to explain. That's sort of what esoteric means. Instead, I'll try to explain Biotti's main reason for what he did, beyond the impetus of fear and the harmonic convergence. The poor devil loved humanity, I think. He wanted humanity to be happy, I think. Or he at least wanted humanity to have a chance to be happy. And if you wipe humanity out, what chance is left for improvement of any kind? He really didn't think that we'd be happy destroying ourselves, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. He thought that we, as a species, maybe not counting me, I guess, would be happier if the Earth accidentally fell into the sun or something. Not that there's any indication of that, you understand. Because at least then it wouldn't be our fault. At least then we wouldn't have to feel like a bunch of assholes and dickheads who just plain had to wipe ourselves out. It was really that simple. There were, however, choices to be made, leading inexorably to the fact that there still are consequences to be faced and prices to be paid. There would be unfortunate side effects that would have to be accepted as a necessary evil. Chief among these are the eventual deaths of everybody on the planet due to causes other than nuclear war. Those familiar with my comic book, Goblin Hood's Comics and Poems, and specifically with a short story therein entitled Piccalilli and Death Perception in the Muffin Realm, will already recognize Viotti's tendency to blame himself for deaths that he really had nothing tangible to do with. Well, this that I'm talking about isn't that, okay? This isn't even a lightning round of let's blame Goblin Hood or whatever. No, this is just an aspect of how Viotti's plan had to work, if it actually did work. I mean, everybody has to die somehow, right? Everybody real, that is. I'm told that it's a basic fact of life for humans, and while it certainly seems odd, to say the least, I'm afraid that I'm not really in a position to dispute the notion. I'm forced to believe that it's a true fact. By preventing us from destroying ourselves all at once in a brief flurry of mushroom clouds, Viotti condemned each of us. Well, each of you, anyway, don't know about us artificial life forms, to die alone, or at least individually, in a myriad of ways, pretty much at random, or at least just according to the luck of the draw, which might not be quite the same thing from a tarot reader's viewpoint. Too bad, of course, but it was going to happen anyway, one way or another, am I right? And Viotti just wasn't the kind of person who would let scruples about something like this stop him. Call it tough love, if you want to. He did it for our own good. He knew he was doing it, too. It was necessary, he felt. But it was awfully damned cold as well. Passion couldn't come into it, except on a big and impersonal scale. So legal counsel for the man who murdered the world cannot exercise the option of claiming that this was a crime of passion, except on a big and impersonal scale.
Immortality, you say? Why didn't Viotti use his magic or whatever for that?
Well, maybe he couldn't. That's the simplest answer. Maybe physical immortality for humans just wasn't on the menu. Or, to put it into the terms that we've already stipulated, maybe finding a future time track, sans nuclear war, was a lot easier than locating one where humans wouldn't die at all, which might not even have been possible.
for that matter, maybe human immortality didn't even seem as harmless to the warlock in question as the idea of preferring eventual death by natural causes to nuclear holocaust. It's hard to say what controlled this decision. Maybe it was just a decision subject to some irrevocable and inviolable cosmic law, natural or otherwise. Maybe human beings were meant to die, and that's just that. Besides, if humans ever do develop immortality on their own, it will be limited to the rich and privileged. You all already know that, damn it. And even if we all somehow had it, we'd just be overbreeding ourselves right off the planet. We're already doing that anyway, right? And if you throw in immortality, then the rich and powerful, in order to fully enjoy this planet, will be shipping all the rest of us off to places like Planet Podunk, whether we want to go or not. So what are you yelping about? It's better the way things are. In any case, it wasn't Beatty's intention to change everything. He just wanted to prevent one thing. And maybe he managed that. It's difficult to say. There are still plenty of nuclear weapons around, you know. And there are still things like chemical and biological weapons, or even limited nuclear terrorist strikes, let alone nuclear energy malfunctions, ecological catastrophes, and of course, that good old standby, conventional war. If Beatty committed any real oversight, it was in not finding a future where the constant threat of nuclear war wouldn't be immediately replaced by constant conventional war, as seems to be the case in Bosnia, for instance, after the Soviet Union fell apart. And there are things, individual, personal, hellish things, about conventional war that make nuclear war look good. But maybe a world without any war wasn't on the menu either. Sadly, that might have to mean a world without the human race. Maybe Beatty simply did the best that he could. But anyway, that's the story. And through it all, ironically, Beatty's hardest task was to ignore his own secret desire to just go ahead and die in a thermonuclear conflagration. There's something so poisonously attractive sometimes about mass suicide. Just ask the lemmings. Yes, global insanity can be compellingly seductive, but I'm not about to list its dubious merits here. Fortunately, Beatty was able to put his own selfish interests aside in the belief that everybody else's chance for happiness outweighed his own sense of
despair and hopelessness. And I think maybe that's what those parking lot people in the dream were really celebrating. Viotti's triumph in this for the past decade or so. They would have known all about it, of course, as envoys from his subconscious. They weren't really celebrating Libby's death. They were reminding the dreamer that every death, by anything other than nuclear war, is part of the solution, or at least part of the bargain. And Libby herself? Would she have been happy about any of this? Well, I didn't get to ask her in the dream. As for how Viotti and I both remember her, yeah, I think maybe so. Her death was tragic, but I think that she was also the kind of person who would have welcomed and maybe even embraced any death if she thought that it would help prevent nuclear war. I like to think so. Anyway, it makes me feel less alone and less cold. Talk about cold, though, or at least crass. It was time now for the long-awaited air show, supposedly a tribute to Libby. And I don't know where the hell this came from. Viotti's subconscious mind must have pulled it right out of his subconscious ass. The show turned out to be a blimp. Actually, a triple blimp in the shape of a beer truck, of all things, hauling two big trailers. The beer company involved was the same one that uses penguins in their commercials, I guess for their icy connotations. The truck, blimp, maybe call it a trip, sailed majestically through the lurid sky, not very high up, over the Dream's End Apocalypso Bar and Grill and its parking lot. On the other side of the, on the side of the first trailer, seemingly written or carved in ice, were simply Libby's name and the dates of her birth and death. 8 years to react. I still can't believe it. Or is it that I still can't believe it after 8 years? The second trailer, though, makes the word crass seem almost complimentary. This featured a big legend which simply stated, "There's been a plane crash," and depicted behind those words was a beer truck, same brand, of course, in flames, falling out of the sky. I kid you not. The parking lot crowd, at any rate, seemed to like the show in a subdued kind of a way. I didn't know whether cheering was supposed to be appropriate or not, even if it had been worth cheering for. This wasn't the 4th of July, after all. More like a kind of wake. There were, in fact, a few feeble cheers, but I settled for grudgingly muttering, "Good blimp,"
I guess. Awfully nice of the beer company to do this for Libby and all that, I guess I'd like to suppose. But they wasted their nickel if they thought that this was a tasteful way to honor her memory. Hell, that second trailer was little more than a thinly disguised advertisement for their fucking beer. But now I saw that the monstrous vessel was actually coming in for a landing, settling down right here in our parking lot. On the ground, the back of that second trailer opened up, and people started climbing in and trundling out big wagons. No, they were actually rolling dumpsters, filled not with beer, but with ice. They started pushing these into a big circle around me in my dumpster, almost like Stonehenge or something, I guess. It also reminded me a little of movie Apaches orbiting an encircled wagon train. A folk guitarist, a guy I know from Comfest, pushed one of the ice-filled dumpsters right up to me and said, "It's for Libby, for her monument." Oh, so that was it. It was all just ice for Libby's monument. Why hadn't I thought of that? Ice for Libby's monument. What a novel concept. And maybe some of the ice around my heart was beginning to melt. Or maybe the news was finally catching up with me emotionally. But suddenly I felt like crying. Only I couldn't. I don't think I've ever cried as Goblinhood. I don't think it's even in my job description. And Beatty? When he's able to cry at all, it usually turns into some kind of hysterical laughter, rapidly spiraling out of his control until it stops of its own accord. So it's something he tries stolidly to avoid. So we couldn't cry, though we certainly felt like it. Catharsis comes hard to the terminally mind-boggled, judging from this anyway. And so I just sat there, almost crying, on my small mountain of ice, with my right elbow resting on the dumpster's edge. And this woman came up and kind of leaned heavily against my elbow, pinning it to the dumpster's metal rim. And this oddly comforted me, though I knew that my elbow wouldn't be feeling any too good about it by and by. But I didn't want to move my elbow for fear of maybe spooking her away, the way one might be reluctant to disturb an infant or even a kitten that's fallen asleep in one's lap. It comforted me because the woman was Libby, having found a place to park her car, I suppose. But at the same time, she was also someone else, an almost anonymous woman whom I'd met running a Comfest booth at some point. She sort of fluctuated between being the two in a way that seemed wholly natural at the time. Her proximity, her very presence,
seemed natural too, and I don't think she even realized that she was pinning my elbow down like that. In any case, I wouldn't have had it any other way. But then, wanting to speak to her, I suddenly found myself, absurdly to be sure, stuck in the kind of situation that only an artificial life form or its creator can get into, something that Beati and I both call the goblinhood dilemma. I don't know whether or not she even, I didn't know whether or not she even knew me. If she was a so-called goblinhood friend, she might never have met Beati, who wasn't exactly here just now anyway, but she would have recognized me. Whereas, under those circumstances, if Beati had been the one here, he'd have had to introduce himself to her as the guy under the mask. The thing was, I couldn't remember which of us had met that Comfest woman who this person seemed to be about half the time. As for Libby, she probably wouldn't even have known me as Goblinhood in this particular mask. And so, what to do? Meanwhile, I think this particular confusion was one of the reasons why Beati sort of arbitrarily decided that I should narrate this ending. If he'd tried to do it, then the problem wouldn't even have been this clear. As it turned out, though, no introductions were necessary. The Libby aspect of my companion eventually recognized her old friend Beati right through the mask. "Got a cigarette, Jim?" she asked, smiling, and I thrilled to hear Libby's voice just the way that I remembered it. "Well, that settles that," I thought, because my right arm was still immobilized. I had to dig left-handedly in my shirt pocket for one of the smokes left over from that weird basement party of so long ago. But I was more than happy to be able to oblige her in this. Even so, my mind couldn't resist twitting me. "She'll have to light it herself. I'm a little short-handed just now." Still, I was groping left-handedly in my pocket for matches when the end abruptly came.